that are being used to try to counter the biblical creation model as I presented in the previous session. And I want to use this Bill Nye-Ken Ham debate as the starting point for this, because I believe that Bill Nye brought up several really good points that that really require some scientific investigation in order to figure out the answer, to figure out how the evidence that you see from the natural realm, how that fits with what the Bible teaches. And so I think this will serve as a good study of this question. And we've got copies of an issue in Reason and Revelation about this subject, and we have several available for free out in the foyer. And then we also have this available online where you can go and view this in a more technical way. It has a lot more material than I'll be able to cover in this particular presentation. But in this debate, Bill Nye, the science guy, squared off against Ken Ham, who's the director of Answers in Genesis, which is a young earth creation type organization, not affiliated with Churches of Christ. This is a denominational organization. And Bill Nye, again, brought up a lot of good points that Ken Ham did not take time to counter. And therefore, I feel like these things could be become issues that we need to, that we'll be dealing with more often, because it might have left the impression that there aren't answers to the things that Bill Nye brought up. Some of the things that he brought up that were unanswered are the idea that there are hundreds of thousands of years worth of ice layers in the ice cores, and yet the biblical model would say the earth is roughly 6,000 to 8,000 years old. He says you've got trees that can be dated and found to be older than the flood, and even some of them older than when we would say creation would be. How can that be explainable in a creation model? He says you've got civilizations with histories that predate the flood. That shouldn't be the case. All civilization would have been wiped out at the flood. He says, okay, if all of the creatures, all of the animals were on the ark, and then God destroys everything with a flood, how do you then get the animals from the ark to places like Australia after the flood? How are you going to be able to do that? And so that was a question that he had. He says, okay, if you had, say, 7,000 species on the ark, representative species, how do you get from that to the some 16 million species that are on the planet today? That would be about 11 new species coming about every day over 4,000 years. How do we explain that? How do you explain the fact that there wouldn't have been enough space for that many species to be on this vessel, for all of the beings that would have been on that vessel? How would we explain that? And then he cited a large wooden vessel, the Wyoming, which we know was not able to withstand being out on the open seas. It ultimately ended up sinking because it was so large, its wooden planks and so forth caused it to leak and ultimately sink. And so I feel like all seven of these are good questions and worthy of our consideration, worthy of responding to. Now, the creation model, as I presented it this morning, gives you a foundation for being able to respond to these things. And that's one of the reasons why you want to have a model. It helps you to respond to criticisms and so forth, and it helps you to know the sorts of things that we need to study and flesh out in order to determine the true account of what has happened in history. So let's look at that first one on the list. Are there hundreds of thousands of years worth of layering in these ice cores in Greenland and Antarctica? So first of all, you have to understand what an ice core is. This is where they'll go in and drill a hole all the way down into these layers of ice in Greenland and Antarctica and pull up these tubes of ice, and then you can see these layers. You can see these layers in these big tubes of ice that they bring up. And so they say, hey, you've got hundreds of thousands of years worth of these layers. They're forming about one layer per year, and you got hundreds of thousands of years worth of these. How do you explain these? Okay, well, in response, first of all, we would say this is based on uniformitarianism, which we've discussed a lot this weekend. This is fundamental to naturalistic thinking. Whatever you see going on today, whatever rates you see going on today, it is assumed it's always been that way throughout history, and so it doesn't account for major cataclysmic activity such as we would predict with our model, the flood model. So if more than one layer can be laid down each year, for example, it would totally destroy the assumption that these ice cores can be used in dating. And that evidence does exist. In fact, we know that individual storms or cyclical weather patterns can cause layers that resemble annual layers in these ice cores. And then you'll notice this morning I talked about this ice age that we would say came after the flood. So the flood model would argue that there was a great ice advance period for several hundred years after the flood with turbulent weather causing as many as 1,000 annual cycles of ice in just 1 year. And so that is, based on the biblical model, what we would say is actually going on here. Now, modern estimates for ice accumulation in Greenland are less than 1 foot per year. But even in modern times, we have examples of the rapid deposition of ice rather than the uniformitarian deposition. So, for example, in 1988, GPR, ground penetrating radar, was used to discover the location of some abandoned World War II planes from 1942 in Greenland. And surprisingly, the planes had been buried under more than 260 feet of ice. Now, this is over 5 feet of ice forming every year for 46 years, rather than the modern estimates of less than 1 foot per year. So notice that even in modern times, uniformitarian estimates for ice layers don't coincide with the actual observable evidence that you find when you go out and look at this as a scientist. So Bill Nye's use of ice cores to prove an old Earth simply doesn't hold ice under scrutiny. So Bill Nye argued that there are bristlecone pine trees alive today that are as many as 6,800 years old, and even a Norway spruce, old Chico, that is 9,550 years old. So if so, then these trees would have had to survive the flood, possibly even creation week, precede creation week. And so this would seem to be a major problem for the creation model as well. So first of all, you have to understand tree dating to respond to this. You have to understand what dendrochronology is. This is where scientists will study the rings of a tree and use that to try to figure out not only the age of a tree, but you can learn things about the weather patterns and so forth in a certain area in the past. And usually, you've got one tree ring that forms every year. And so you theoretically can just count up all of the rings that you find in a tree, and that'll tell you how old it is. Now, he specifically mentioned old bristlecone pine trees, 6,000 to 7,000 years old. Now, one of the things you have to ask is what bristlecone pine tree is he talking about? He didn't actually get specific. The oldest living bristlecone was discovered in 2012 and dated at 5,062 years old. And that was using tree ring counting and cross dating, which is another method. So 5,062 years old. So that means it started growing around 3,000 BC. Now, is that a problem for the creation model? Well, it sounds like it if you have a tree older than when the flood was supposed to occur. The biblical model places the flood as recent as 2,300 years based on a straightforward reading of the chronologies of Genesis 11 coupled with history. So really, we're talking 4,300 years ago, but there is room to expand that number by several years in the chronologies of there in Genesis 11. You see our website for some material on that. You actually have some wiggle room of a few hundred years there. So that already eliminates the problem that Bill Nye is using here. He's asserting. But consider also that, once again, uniformity is assumed in tree ring dating. You're assuming one ring per year. Now, we know today that rings don't always correlate with single years. Sometimes rings can form subannually. When you have a time-staggered, repeated disturbance that can be caused by unusual weather patterns, for example, this has been shown to severely affect tree ring patterns. Now, again, you think about our model that I mentioned this morning. You've got this post-flood ice age ensuing during the formative years of the oldest trees that we have around, causing repeated major storms and atmospheric disturbances, extra snowing and so forth. You've got climatic weather going on. The circumstances really were perfect for the creation of multiple annual tree rings. So it's very possible that these bristlecone pines are actually several years younger than they might appear at first glance. So where did he get 6,800 as opposed to 5,062 as the age of the bristlecones? Well, it's unclear. You ultimately have to make his argument for him. He says these are still living, so you can't even argue that he's talking about cross-dating with trees that are already dead. Okay, so you can have dead trees and use what's called cross-dating. This is where dendrochronologists can successively overlap tree ring patterns from living trees and dead trees and try to correlate the tree ring patterns and try to get a history that goes back further. You might even look at fossilized trees in order to try to get a pattern that goes all the way back. Now, you can probably already surmise this is a very imprecise and sometimes very subjective way of dating. We've got, for example, trees that are living today in the same forest that don't always have the same tree ring pattern, because this is affected by many things. The distance of that tree from water, the direction the sunlight's hitting that tree, the particular soil nutrients in that area, storm patterns. But it is argued, hey, you can date back over 8,000 years. And so the flood 4 to 5,500 years ago, typically. So if that's true, that would sound like a problem for the flood model. But notice it's only potentially a problem if you assume that all trees could not survive the flood. And we have to be careful here. The text says all flesh died that moved on the earth. It doesn't mention the plants. Some areas of the planet may have had less turbulence. And we know that some trees could have been more robust due to the optimized nature of the pre-flood environment. You know, you've got people living longer, you've got plants growing larger, you've got these extremely large reptilian creatures. Bert Craig of the Department of Horticulture and Forestry at Michigan State, he says, we know many tree species that can survive months underwater in flooding-type conditions. Horticulturalist Whitlow and Harris produced a monumental work on the effect of flooding on trees, documenting dozens of species that are able to survive deep flooding for one growing season and even for more than a year. And so if trees survive the flood, either because they survive being underwater or because they were brought on the ark with Noah, then trees with over 6,000 rings even wouldn't be a problem. Now that said, even if cross-dating could legitimately take us back thousands of years further than the flood and even further than creation, we have to consider that God would have created the earth with the appearance of age. And this is another fundamental component of the creation model. And so, for example, whenever God created Adam and Eve, the first day that they were created, God was able to communicate with them, unlike you can with a child. They were able to, Adam was able to tend the garden. He and Eve could procreate because God was telling them to be fruitful and multiply. He was able to engage in biological classification. And so all of this, the first day he was created, he had an immediate appearance of age. I would suspect that the trees of the garden would have had tree rings in them. Why? Because Adam and Eve had to eat the fruit from these trees. So they're already mature and bearing fruit. And so you would expect them to have tree rings, because the purpose of tree rings is not to tell us time. It's to provide strength to a tree as it's getting larger. Each of those rings provides more strength to the tree and makes sure that it won't fall down in time and so forth. So I would expect that even the trees of the garden already had rings, even though they had just been created. I would argue that there could have been daughter elements already on the earth. There could have been both parent and daughter elements. What we're talking about here is radioactive material that where you have one type of element breaking down into another type of isotope over time. And it's usually assumed in uniformitarian dating methods that everything was originally all the first element, the parent element. But it's possible that God could have created even rocks that would have had both parent and daughter elements in them, immediately giving them an appearance of age. We'd say the same thing with regard to starlight. There could have been an immediate appearance of age. Light from stars that are billions of light years could have already been created in place. Therefore, what we call mature light. That's one possible explanation as to how we can see starlight from so far away. So bottom line, tree ages can't be conclusively known due to the possibility of subannual rings and the subjective nature of cross-dating and the possibility that God created maturity with regard to creation. All right, now specifically, what about Old Chico? Old Chico. This old Norway spruce, which Bill Nye mentioned as being 9,550 years old. Now, this tree was dated using carbon dating, not dendrochronology. So this is not even typically listed among the verified oldest trees. And you'll recall from a presentation that Mike Houts did yesterday why that would be. C14 dating is known to be notoriously imprecise and suspect beyond really just a few thousand years, caused in large part by its foundational assumptions. We keep coming back to assumptions this weekend. These particular assumptions concern the effect of the Earth's magnetic field on the production rate of C14 and the assumption that the ratio of C14 to C12 in the atmosphere has remained constant throughout history, which scientists now reject. Archaeologist Brian Fagan of UC Santa Barbara, he noted that carbon dating is not infallible, and in general, single dates should not be trusted. Tree ages simply can't be used to disprove the creation model here. All right, number three, according to Bill Nye, you know, there are human populations that are far older than that, talking about the flood, with traditions that go back farther than that. Now, if that's true, that would seem to contradict the biblical text, because according to the Bible, all civilizations were annihilated at the flood, and only those civilizations that would have emerged after the flood, and especially after Babel, should have distinct traditions. Now, once again, I first have to ask, what civilization are you referring to? Because he didn't get specific about what he's even talking about. So we're left to guess and make his argument for him. And this is an important thing to always try to nail somebody down on when you're talking to them and they're making accusations. Is he talking about China? Well, in China, we only have records that go back to 1600 BC. And beyond that, it's uncorroborated legend. Chinese history cannot be said to pose a conclusive problem for the creation model. This is the Sumerians. 2700 BC is the date for the earliest known Sumerian king. The Sumerian language is said to be the oldest written language, and it's claimed to date back to 3100 BC. But notice what the Encyclopedia Britannica says about this. The chronology of the first half of the third millennium is largely a matter for the intuition of the individual author. Carbon-14 datings are at present too few and far between to be given undue weight. Consequently, the turn of the fourth to third millennium is to be accepted with due caution and reservations as the date of the invention of writing. And so even the date of 3100 BC is speculative, and even if it's right, it still falls after possible flood date estimates, which can be as high as 3500 BC or further, based on the biblical text. Now, what about Egypt? Scholars consider 3100 BC to be the commencement of the first Egyptian dynasty. And again, that can't be conclusively known for the same reasons as Sumer, especially due to the inexact nature of tree ring dating, which we've already looked at, pottery comparison, C14 dating, which again is very suspect, as Mike talked about yesterday, and historical records as well. Some scholars believe that even that date of 3100 BC can be collapsed a few hundred more years into the 2000s BC. So either way, all of these dates from China, Sumer, Egypt can fit within the biblical model. So bottom line, Bill Nye's claims don't carry any weight. They don't disprove the biblical account. But I do notice an interesting pattern here. Notice that the oldest living trees date back to roughly 3100 BC. The Egyptian dynasty goes back to about 3100 BC. The origin of the written language in Sumer goes back to about 3100 BC with no verifiable civilizations before that time. Does it sound to you like something significant is going on there? Isn't this exactly what we would predict if the flood occurred? Something significant seems to have happened immediately prior to that time period, and all of a sudden you've got this emergence of all kinds of civilization, writing, all kinds of things going on. So I would say that the post-story of the flood is actually being verified from multiple independent directions. All right, number four, if there was a global flood, how do you get the animals to Australia once they leave the ark? You know, you got Australia way out there, away from any continent. Any animal that was once on it before, any animal that was on Australia before the flood would have been killed. And so, how do you get the animals out there to Australia from the ark after the flood? Well, number one, if this is a problem for creationists, why isn't it just as much of a problem for the evolutionist to explain? How do you get animals to Australia, even if you're an evolutionist? Evolutionists are going to be in a fix to try to assert that the animals in Australia evolve completely separately from their own single-celled organism that separately sprang to life hundreds of millions of years ago and evolved into kangaroos. How do you get animals to Australia if you're an evolutionist? Well, whatever you come up with, why couldn't you use a similar argument as a creationist? Number two, Bill Nye summarily dismissed the idea of a land bridge from Asia to Australia without any thought, as though that's not a possibility. So notice, though, that there are islands all along the path from China down to Australia. And the water between those islands can be very misleading because it hides what's really under there. Notice from this map of the Pacific Sea floor that the continental shelf of China actually extends all the way down to the continental shelf of Australia with only a relatively small gap between the two. Now again, you got to keep in mind the model that I talked about this morning. With lower waters because of the ice age, you got more ice at the poles. These continents could have once been very close to each other and even making travel, therefore, from one to the other feasible. Another option, as I talked about this morning, the creation model doesn't have a problem with the supercontinent idea, Pangaea, or again, before that, Rodinia or Gondwana. So this is the idea that the continents at one time were all together in one supercontinent. Notice what Genesis 1:9 says concerning the origin of land. Then God said, let the waters under the heavens be gathered together into one place and let the dry land appear. Now, if God's gathering together all of the waters in one place, then doesn't that imply that all the land would also be in one place? I mean, is this a potential allusion to what we're talking about with the single ultimate continent like that? Also, keep in mind what I talked about this morning with regard to Genesis chapter 7 and verse 11. Where it says, concerning the flood, that all of the fountains of the great deep were broken up and the windows of heaven were open. And remember, I talked about catastrophic plate tectonics this morning and the idea that that would have broken apart the plates at that point and started moving all the continents around. And so you're imagining all of this cataclysmic geologic activity going on along these continental plates, causing the continents to separate. Now again, the uniformitarian assumption is the key to understanding continental drift and continental plate movement from a creationist perspective. Today, the continental separation is on the order of centimeters per year, but what if it was much quicker during and immediately after the flood? Which, remember this morning I talked about under the creation model, this is happening rapidly during the flood and immediately after. Interestingly, recent research by Yale University geologists provides evidence for the claim that the movement of these plates used to be much faster. In fact, at least three times faster than it is today. Notice what they say. These observations suggest that either non-uniformitarian plate tectonics or an episode of rapid true polar wander occurred during the Cambrian explosion of animal life. Notice two things about this recent study. Number one, it provides evidence that substantiates the creationist theory that, hey, things used to move, the plates were moving much faster in the past. So we would predict that. They're finding evidence that verifies it. Number two, it highlights the fact that this accelerated drift occurred in the same time period as whatever catastrophic event caused the Cambrian explosion. Now, guess what creationists would say the Cambrian explosion represents? That's the beginning of the flood. There's no question about it. I don't even know any creation geologist that disagrees with that. When you see the Cambrian explosion on the earth, that is the beginning of the flood. You've got this explosion of fossils right down there at the base of the column, where you really the first place you really start seeing the diversity of life that we have on the planet. So bottom line, if the continents were together or much closer to one another immediately after the flood, then getting animals from one continent to another wouldn't be as insurmountable as one might think today. But you've got other options for the creation model as well. It's possible that the post-flood ice age could have allowed migration across frozen channels. And another plausible option, there would have been no doubt dead pre-flood forests floating on the receding waters of the earth for some time after the flood. This would have made many, many land masses, tiny land masses for travel across channels. Notice this image from the Telegraph. This is a popular newspaper out of the UK. And then notice the title of the article that contained this picture. Massive floating rubbish islands from the Japan tsunami are spotted on the Pacific. So this is a picture of basically a massive island of trees and rubbish that were floating on the ocean after this big Japan tsunami. Now here's a shot of this island floating across the Pacific towards the U.S. West Coast. And this particular debris island is 69 miles in length and covers an expanse of over 2.2 million square feet. Notice this picture. In the description, it explains that members of the Japan Coast Guard found and rescued this dog from a debris island from the tsunami 3 weeks after the tsunami. So ironically, a very similar rubbish island in the very same Pacific Ocean may be precisely what allowed animals to cross to Australia thousands of years ago. It's not at all outlandish to suppose that massive debris islands would have been found worldwide after the flood, and that animals could have been found floating on these in the years immediately after the flood, in the same way you see this dog on there, on this island three weeks after that tsunami occurred. So if a tsunami in one small area of the world could have made such a floating island of trees and debris, what would a global flood have created? Even more substantial islands of debris like those depicted in this painting by Louis Lavoie, who illustrated our Dinosaurs Unleashed book. Number five, according to Bill Nye, this is an interesting one. If you got 16 million species today in existence and there was only some 7,000 species on the ark 4,000 years ago, that would require 11 completely new species emerging every day since the flood. Now, I first heard that, I thought, wow, you know, that's a good point. What's going on here? That sounds pretty unrealistic. Doesn't that seem to imply that 4,000 years is just not enough time to give rise to the diversity that we have today? Okay, so first of all, keep in mind, he's right in his representation of one thing about the flood model. We don't claim all current species were on the ark. Not every variety of dog, for example, would have been on the ark. Species is a modern concept. We would argue what the text argues. The different kinds of animals were on the ark, Genesis 6:20. So, for example, maybe a representative dog kind from which came all of the dogs you have today, the domestic dog breeds, as well as maybe the wolves, the foxes, the coyotes. There was probably a cat kind, a horse kind, an elephant kind, and so forth on the ark. So something, again, more like the modern taxonomic category, family or genus. And so there was no need to fit every single modern species on the ark, which would be difficult if not impossible, and there's no need to, since many different species within a kind could come about through what we call microevolutionary change. That's not Darwinian evolution, which is what we call macroevolution. We're talking about small changes within a kind. It might change size, it might change your beak size, your color, that sort of thing. What you might call diversification within a kind. This is what we would call microevolution. Under the flood model, we have to be able to explain how we could get from an initial relatively few species on the ark to the tremendous variety that we have today in just a few thousand years. And that's ultimately the argument being made here. So Nye said there were 7,000 proto-species on the ark, and he said he was quoting Ken Ham. We don't know for sure that it was 7,000 original species, although creation biologists are studying that question right now. Could have been more, could have been less. So here's what he said. So you'd go out into your yard, you wouldn't just find a different bird, a new bird. You would find a different kind of bird, a whole new species of bird every day. This would be enormous news. I mean, the last 4,000 years, people would have seen these changes among us. We see no evidence of that. There's no evidence of these species. How come nobody's noticing 11 new species coming about every day? That just seems unrealistic, Bill Nye is saying. All right, now in response, again, first I'd like to know, where did he get his 16 million count for the number of species? And so that's always the first thing to do when somebody comes up and make these challenges. What are you talking about? Give me your facts here. There is a lot of disagreement about how many species there are today on the planet, but that number is extremely high. Some estimates are as low as 3 million. One study from 2011 that seems to be accepted by many, so much so that it was published by the Public Library of Science Biology Division, estimated not 16 million, but 10,960,000. And that estimate included not only the kingdom Animalia, but the plants. It included fungi, protozoa, chromista, archaea, and even bacteria. Okay, so keep in mind also that these are estimates. The actual cataloged number of species on the planet in 2011 was only 1,438,769. And so they're projecting that eventually we think we're going to find roughly 11 million. All right, so Bill Nye also needs to be sure to accurately reflect what the creation model really claims. From this 11 million estimate that they put out, don't you need to subtract the marine creatures? from this estimate, they wouldn't have been on the ark. The text doesn't say that. There would have been no need for that. So you remove the ocean-dwelling creatures, that gets you down to 8.7 million. Possibly other creatures that could survive in water could be removed, various amphibians, but for the sake of argument, we'll leave those in there in our count. You got to remove the plants. Again, the text doesn't mention plants being taken onto the ark since they're not flesh, Genesis 6:19. So that brings you down to 8.4 million. Now, incidentally, again, would plants have survived in the flood if they weren't taken onto the ark? And no doubt many certainly would have died, though again, as I said earlier, not necessarily all of them. Interestingly, most of the planet's plants are in fact under the water today. But also seeds could have been brought onto the ark, or perhaps more likely, you have to consider the seeds that would have been available on the dead plants floating on the waters of the flood that would have then regerminated. So studies show that seeds can survive submersion in salt water for extended periods of time. And ironically, Darwin himself even conducted one of those studies for evolutionary purposes. Next, you have what are called synonymous species. This is where you've got two names given to the same single species. So creatures that were originally thought to be two distinct species that are now considered to be one and the same, or one creature whose name has changed over time, and yet both names have been unintentionally counted. Now, the Public Library of Science Biology paper highlighted this weakness in species estimates and explained that a survey of, notice, 2,938 taxonomists with expertise across all major domains of life revealed that synonyms are a major problem at the species level. They believe that 17.9% of all named species could be synonyms, and possibly many more, as much as 46.6%, roughly half of the species. The World Register of Marine Species actually documents that 44.5% of all accepted marine species are synonyms. Now, if we take the lowest estimate of synonymous species, that only 17.9% of the remaining species on our chart here are synonyms, that brings you down to 6.9 million. Now notice this is a far cry from that initial estimate of 16 million. Now if the flood was 4,500 years ago instead of 4,000, which would be closer to our estimate, that's going to bring us down to four species every day that needed to emerge rather than the 11 that he claimed, in order to get from what was on the ark to what we have today. Now, if there are fewer species than the projections, if there are more synonyms, if you've got more years since the flood to now, if you have more species that could survive outside the ark and more representative kinds on the ark, then that number gets much smaller, and we're still not done. Insects, other invertebrates, fungi, bacteria, protozoa, these were all included in that list of 11 million species, even though many of these wouldn't have been on the ark. Invertebrates, for example, make up 95 to 99% of the planet's animal species. Insects alone make up about half of the remaining 6.9 million species. Many of these could have survived outside the ark, significantly reducing this remaining list, although admittedly some creeping things might have included some of the insects that were brought onto the ark, since not all of those could survive during the flood. Now, of those that are left, keep in mind, the fast reproductive rates of those insects on the ark, for example, would cause rapid diversification of those creatures within the original ark kinds. Flies, for example, can lay as many as 100 eggs per day. According to the American Society for Microbiology, one bacteria can produce 10 billion in 10 hours. And so many new species could have been emerging rapidly in the centuries immediately following the flood, and the rate would have since slowed down to a certain extent today because of niche conservatism and so forth. One study from 1988 that was published in Science Magazine highlighted the correlation between these smaller-sized creatures being represented by more of the species on the planet, which provides evidence for this idea that the smaller creatures that reproduce quicker would have been more prone to the rapid speciation. So bottom line, 11 new species a day is nowhere near an accurate assessment of the data. Even four would be quite an overstatement, and most of those would be tiny creatures, completely unnoticed by humans, even though Bill Nye argues that such rapid speciation would have been noticed by humans. He's simply wrong about that. So you have to consider the earth has a volume of over 1 trillion cubic kilometers. Okay, humans only inhabit a tiny space of the earth comparatively. And therefore, we're really just not in a position to know what all is going on in and on the earth. So the odds that a species would happen to evolve in our backyard, as he suggests, much less that it would be large enough for us to see it, is essentially zero. But even in spite of that, here's the ironic thing that Bill Nye missed. According to the literature, scientists are still discovering 15,000 new species every year. Now, guess how many newly discovered species that averages out to every day that we're running across? That's 41. 41 new species that we're discovering every year rather than just the 11. This is just not a problem for the creation model. Number 6, Bill Nye says, hey, we don't have enough space on the ark to fit these 7,000 species. He says, the National Zoo only has 400 species and it takes 163 acres to house them all. How in the world is the ark going to be able to hold 14,000 creatures? Now, again, it's uncertain whether 14,000 is a good estimate of the representative proto-species that would have been on the ark. For the sake of argument, let's go with that. Number one, isn't it true that the ark and a zoo aren't really a good parallel? Now, think about it. The ark was about, it was not about display. It was about basic shelter. And so a better parallel would be maybe a factory farm or high-density housing facilities, which can house tens of thousands of animals in tight quarters under one roof. And secondly, if the cubit is 18 inches, as many scholars estimate, so we're talking about the length from the elbow to the tip of the middle finger, then the ark would have been 450 feet long, so football field and a half long, 75 feet wide, 45 feet high. Creation geologist and biologist John Woodmerappy did an extensive study on how much space would be required to house 16,000 animals instead of 14,000, as Bill Nye brought up. So this is representatives of each genus, taking into account food, water, waste disposal, heating, ventilation, and lighting, and found that the ark was more than adequate in size to be able to house that number of animals on that size vessel. But also consider, what if humans were generally larger in the pre-flood era due to better health and life longevity? So after all, again, we know about enormous reptiles existed in the past. We know about enormous fruit that had to be carried by two men on poles within a few centuries after the flood. You know of enormous humans mentioned in Genesis 6. We also know of Homo heidelbergensis, for example. These are fossils from really what we would say is right after the flood that are representatives of humans being larger. What if humans were in general larger? So what if the cubit was actually longer than 18 inches at that time? Well, our estimates, all of a sudden this changes. A 25-inch cubit instead of an 18-inch cubit would more than double the volume of space on the ark. It would change from 1.5 million cubic feet to 4 million cubic feet. So, of course, we could also reason that the animals would likely not have been full-sized animals. Why would we say that? They could have been babies or adolescents. Why? Well, for one, it would make it where those animals could survive longer after the flood to help repopulate the planet. Besides, of course, the fact they take up less space, eat less food, cause less waste. But of course, you're going to expect that God wants younger creatures so they have time to spread out and repopulate. And so we would predict these would have been smaller infant forms or adolescent forms of all of these animals on the ark. So Bill Nye's criticism doesn't disprove the biblical account. I would argue it actually gives it another chance to shine. Now, what about the dinosaurs? Would the dinosaurs have been on the ark? And this is we actually received a couple questions in our Q&A about this question. Well, creation scientists know with a high level of confidence where the flood begins in the geologic strata. We believe it begins at the Cambrian strata. And so the Precambrian is before the flood. And this line that separates them is known as the Great Unconformity. It goes across the whole planet. I've been able to go and visit this in some of my creation field trips and see this line. It goes across the planet. It scours the earth. And then all of a sudden, boom, you've got this explosion of fossils that hits. And then above that, you have all of the fossils, really representatives of everything that existed prior to the flood. And the dinosaurs are there. That tells you that the dinosaurs existed at the time of the flood. They didn't go extinct before. So they were alive, which means if they are land-dwelling creatures, they would have been represented on the ark. There's no question about that. And we have evidence of even the dinosaurs existing after the flood, so it's really not even a question. So how in the world do you get these beasts onto the ark? Well, number one, you have to keep in mind that the average size of a dinosaur, we tend to think of the sauropods, you know, the big apatosaurs and so forth. The actual average size is about the size of American bison. But then you have to keep in mind that these are the juvenile forms would have likely been on the ark. Again, not, you know, whenever a brachiosaurus is born, it's not as big as this building, right? It's going to come out a lot smaller at the very beginning. So we don't really have a problem fitting these guys onto the ark either. That's another question to ask, you know, where did they go after the flood? And we've got various theories that can explain that. It might have to do with that post-flood ice age. It could have to do with hunters, alluded to, by the way, in Genesis 10, 8 through 9. Nimrod, right, the mighty hunter. It could have been that the change of the earth's environment was such that it wasn't conducive to their size. It could be that there wasn't enough vegetation for them immediately after the flood. Various explanations as to what ultimately caused their demise. All right, number 7, was the ark seaworthy? And remember, Bill Nye cited this Wyoming, this large wooden ship built back in 1909, and it sank in 1924 due to its tendency, of its long wooden planks to twist and buckle on the heavy seas. Okay, so if you've got these long wooden planks that are tending to twist and buckle, then wouldn't an even larger wooden vessel like the ark be unseaworthy? Well, first, as with the ark in a zoo, the Wyoming and the ark are not a good parallel. And this surprises me because Bill Nye is a mechanical engineer. I don't understand why he's even making this argument. It's really ridiculous in my opinion. The Wyoming had 6 masts and several sails. That would have caused immense torsion from the wind filling those sails on the open seas, definitely causing twisting and buckling. The ark, of course, wouldn't have had sails. It didn't need to go anywhere. And so the torsion problem would have been greatly reduced. It's really not a good parallel. And number 2, we actually know of large ancient wooden ships that have been found that date back to immediately after the flood in Egypt. And they were equipped with a sophisticated interlocking plank system that we as engineers call mortise and tenon joints, which are specifically known to help prevent twisting and provide added strength to the frame. And so we've got large, seaworthy wooden vessels. This is not out of question for the ancients to have been able to make these enormous vessels. Number 3, also, we don't know what gopher wood was. Now, it's notable to me that God was very specific in choosing that as the wood for the ark. Now, Moses mentions several other known species of wood in the Pentateuch. You've got terebinth, you've got green poplar, you've got almond, palm, willow, olive, fig, pomegranate, chestnut, and there's many others in Scripture outside of the Pentateuch as well. But God chose this mysterious gopher, and there really may be no modern equivalent to this when you consider that many of the pre-flood trees likely went extinct, and even those that didn't would have been subject to the same kind of genetic degeneration that we're experiencing today, which Joe talked about yesterday. Everything's going through genetic degeneration in keeping with the second law of thermodynamics, including the trees. And so it's highly unlikely that we even have an equivalent wood today. Gopher wood was clearly chosen because it was conducive to God's instructions for the ark. And also, number 4, notice that the Wyoming, in spite of its problems, stayed afloat for 15 years, while the ark only needed to stay afloat for about 1 year. So Bill Nye didn't show the ark is unseaworthy. Quite the contrary, his accusations, once again, give the creation model, I believe, an opportunity to shine even more. Now, interestingly, the dimensions of the ark have been shown to produce a seaworthy vessel. The SS Great Britain, which was in service in the late 1800s, had a dimension ratio of 322 length to 51 width to 32 height, almost exactly like that of the ark. And then in World War II, you had a group of ships that were constructed, nicknamed the Ugly Ducklings, very similar to the ark. These were cargo ships, built not for speed or for combat. They were just for transporting a lot of stuff through the harsh sea. The SS Jeremiah O'Brien was one of these vessels. And notice when it's converted to feet, 442 feet by 57 feet by 28 feet. And then once you convert cubits to feet from the biblical account, again, this lines up remarkably well with that of the design of the ark. Also, the most recently designed super jumbo barges, which, like the O'Brien, are a good parallel to the Ark, since their purpose is to merely stay afloat while transporting immense amounts of cargo. These modern barges have a length to width dimension ratio very similar to that of the Ark, often ranging between 290 to 50 to 300 to 55 versus the Ark's 300 to 50. So bottom line, clearly somebody knew what he was doing when designing the Ark. He was a great engineer. He was no amateur. So Bill Nye brought up several other points that I address in that reason in Revelation, that responding to that debate. I feel like these were the big ones that I thought were worthy of my own personal research into studying these, but there were several others as well. I would encourage you to get copies of that and make sure you're ready to discuss these with people if they bring them up to you. Thank you again for your attendance tonight. Thank you, those of you especially that attended this seminar from beginning to end. I hope this has been beneficial to you. I know some of this material might have been a little high brow, you know, but that, you know, just kind of depends upon who you're dealing with as to whether or not you need to address a subject on such a technical level. Hopefully it hasn't been too bad. Hopefully it has been useful to you, and it'll help you in your discussions with others and bringing people to Christ, which is ultimately what we're trying to do. And so, as usual, we want to offer, give an opportunity to those that might be interested in becoming a Christian. And as we've said many times before this weekend, our faith is not blind. It's based on evidence, an abundant amount of evidence. God does not want us to believe something without being able to verify it. 1 Thessalonians 5:21. And so those of us in the creation science community, especially those that are members of the Lord's church, acknowledge we want to look at the evidence and figure out what went on and figure out whether it verifies the Bible or whether the Bible somehow contradicts the evidence. As yet, we haven't found anything from science that refutes anything in the Bible. Whenever you give the Bible a fair chance to explain itself and check it contextually and so forth, and so you accept the evidence, believe the evidence, come to the conclusion that God exists, that Jesus is His Son, turn from your sins in repentance, confess Christ with your mouth, and then be immersed in water for the remission of your sins, being added to the one church of the Bible, where you must remain faithful to the end in order to receive a crown of life.